is outdoor explorer on Charles Wolforth. We're getting into new territory with today's show on bike polo and skateboarding. We're calling this edition Fun with Wheels. I'm middle-aged, and a lot of sports have been invented since I was first getting involved. One of them is bike polo, which is played by lots of teams every week in Anchorage. It's what it sounds like, riding a bike while hitting a ball with a stick, like hockey on a bike. Another relatively new sport is boarding, on wheels and on snow. It's both counterculture and mainstream these days, and we'll hear an interview with a former X Games champion from Alaska who eventually came back and opened a shop here to pass on the sport to another generation. My guest right now is Spencer Mitchell, who is a member, organizer, I don't know if they have formal titles, with the Anchorage Bicycle Polo Club, or also known as Anchorage's Finest Bicycle Polo, which I think is a great name. Thanks for being here, Spencer.
Thanks for having me.
So this is, I know what polo is. I don't know that I've ever been to a polo game or match or whatever it is. So you got rich guys on horses with these huge mallets hitting a ball. Look like
riding around on the greens, right. Wearing their khakis and their white shirts.
Mm-hmm. They've got sort of oversized croquet mallets, it looks like. Yeah. So what's bike polo? Is it kind of the same concept?
Well, bicycle polo is similar to horse polo in the way that you ride around with a stick in your hand. Our version of bicycle polo is a little different. What you're going to see is it's not done in grass, it's done on concrete. And it's more like hockey than it is like bicycle polo. They have grass polo here in Anchorage as well, which is done very similar to horse polo, where you have lanes and you ride the ball and you scoop it to the next lane and then they shoot for the goal.
But so there's two different kinds of bicycle polo in Anchorage?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, you're blowing my mind already.
Yeah. It's the grass polo is a little bit smaller. It's more of like an invitation only thing, at least from my experience.
You haven't been invited?
I have been invited, but I just, you know, playing polo 3 days a week is enough for
me. That's it. I need to play
something. I got to go ride my bike other places.
Yeah. Well, I see you're wearing a shirt for the hard court bike polo.
Yeah.
Of New Orleans, Louisiana, which I guess is, so there's hard and soft, in other words.
Yeah, there's grass and there's hardcore. Uh-huh. I don't want to call it soft. That's sort of offensive.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I can see some advantage to that, because if you fell off your bicycle, you would not get scraped up.
You don't have as many cuts and bruises, and it's definitely easier on your body to fall into grass.
So when you guys play this, you play it kind of with like a hockey net?
Yes. So we went and purchased some, you know, Stiga or, you know, whatever Sports Authority brand traveling hockey nets.
Huh.
We put those up. They're actually at the courts at 10th and E, downtown on the Park Strip. So they're locked up and you can go there and use them. Just contact the club and we'll let you use them.
So, and that's a regular hockey rink down there, right?
Yes, that is a regular hockey rink.
Okay, so it's kind of the same size as a hockey. Is it regulation, or are there rules for, is it just sort of however the club wants to do it?
We've considered asking the city to make us regulation courts, but that seems kind of silly and redundant when we've already got so many great hockey courts here that are being resurfaced and having new boards put in and just are nice places. Places down in the States like Seattle, New Orleans as well, don't have as much access to outdoor hockey rinks because it doesn't get cold enough there.
Right. We're pretty unique that way. Yeah.
So in a sense, we're very blessed to have so many options and places where we can go and play. But down in the States, in, you know, British Columbia, they have actual courts that are dedicated for bicycle polo. They call them multi-use courts because you can play dodgeball, kickball, wall ball, stuff like that there. But in general, making a polo-specific court would mean that there'd have to be a much bigger presence in the bike polo community.
So we're getting down in the weeds already, but I mean, would the regulation one be bigger, smaller, same as our hockey?
It's a little bit smaller, it's going to be shorter and just about as wide as most hockey courts. We play down at Ben Bokey Sullivan Arena quite often in the outdoor courts there, and those are very, very large courts for bike polo. You're doing a lot of sprinting back and forth all day.
Well, that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's good. It's nice.
So what do you use? I mean, in polo, like the horse polo, people are always getting hit in the head with the mallet, right? Mm-hmm. It's pretty dangerous. Yeah. What do you use to hit the ball? Do you use a ball? What do you?
Yeah, so we use like a street hockey ball sort of a deal.
Uh-huh.
There's actually a company, it's called Fixcraft, that's actually engineering better balls for bike polo. So you have cold weather, warm weather, and then hot weather.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're hitting this ball really hard, riding over it with your bike, you know, smashing it into a wall.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, ideally, we would be able to use something like a hockey puck, but a hockey puck is too heavy and flat, so it doesn't roll very well on the concrete.
Be hard to hit it, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. but for our mallets, we used, back when I first started, we used ski poles with a piece of 1-inch PVC pipe, and you would bolt it with a screw and wrap the handle in bar tape or electrical tape or whatever kind of tape you had to keep it from tearing up your hands. And that worked really well for a long time. Here, again, we have a huge advantage because you go to REI at the end of the season, you pull all those old ski poles out of the trash can, and bam, you've got a mallet.
Right.
Again, that company, Fixcraft, does make mallet stuff, so they have specific machined aluminum tubing for mallet shafts and head options. And
well, as soon as you invent a sport, you got to have an industry for
exactly.
that sport, right?
Yeah, you got to have some way to get the gear.
Yeah. So are you, like, using official gear now?
Yes. I mean, I do. I really like to have support companies that are supporting bike polo, people who are helping on tournaments, people who are, you know, innovative in the sport and how to make it better, make polo players better, you know. It's like if everybody was still riding a single-speed road bike, the Tour de France would be a much, much slower race.
So do you guys line up like a hockey team, then, or how do you line up at the beginning?
So at the beginning of the game, you'll start three people on each side. You'll have your rear wheel up against the wall behind the net. You go three. Someone from the sidelines will go 3-2-1 polo, and then at polo, you chase the ball. You go, or they'll use a whistle. You charge for the ball. One person, the person on the left side of the net, charges for the ball. And then they play from there.
I would think you'd have collisions constantly.
You know, off a joust, it's not so bad. The reason why the person on the left is supposed to start is to keep your right-handed mallet, you know, mallets in your right hand, left hand's on your bars. And so if you're on the left-hand side of the net, you're charging for the ball, even if both people hit the ball at the same time, charging at full speed, they should not collide with each other. Their mallets might hit each other, but it shouldn't make your bike flip over.
Okay. Well, is that a common thing to have guys run into each other or women run into each other?
It happens. Light contact is a thing you can do in bike polo. The original rule set
was...
So
checking in hockey.
Yeah, similar to checking in hockey, except for you've got a steering arm, and so you're not supposed to hit someone on their steering arm side. So if I have my mallet out and I push at you with your left arm on your bar, that's not... but if you were to check shoulder to shoulder, it is okay. So it's just, it's the rules are fairly convoluted there. Don't be a jerk is really the main point there.
Well, is there a ref? I mean,
at pickup, there's no ref.
Yeah, really.
During tournament play, there are refs.
Because pickup basketball is just as rough as whoever is wants to be
the roughest guy. Yeah,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I have so many questions about this. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about bike polo. As you can tell, I'm a complete beyond newbie. I'm completely ignorant about this. And it's I just think it's so cool, all the new sports that people are inventing and finding different ways to do stuff. And then you get equipment and you get rules and tournaments and everything else blossoms around it. How long has this been around? I feel I should know about this.
Bicycle polo has been around since the 1999 Western Messengers Invitational. A guy named Matthew Messenger grabbed some broomsticks and a street hockey ball and got all his drunk messenger friends to hit this ball around with him into some cones. From there, it developed into something that people really enjoyed. It spread to the East Coast, down the Pacific Coast, and, you know, it's all over the world now. You can play in Australia, you can play in Japan, you can play in New Zealand, South America, Africa, everywhere. It's really neat.
And so you have like you mentioned tournaments. Do you guys travel to play at all?
Yes, we do. This year, me and two of my friends, Brandon Lashua and Liam McMahon, are playing together as a team called the Mies. And we traveled to Fresno, California for a tournament called, Smack in the Middle, and then the Cascade Qualifier for our region. Qualifier.
So is three people a team?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So that makes a little bit more sense to cover like this. I was thinking about this hockey rink with
12 people wanted on bikes and they're like chaos. But if it's only six, okay, I could buy that.
Six people on the court is pretty standard. Uh-huh. There's talk about with bigger courts playing four people on each team. They do bench style tournaments as well, where you'll have five to however many people on one side of the court, same on the other, and then you just kind of sub in like a traditional sports game.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what kind of bike do you use for this?
Originally I used a track bike, just, you know, a single speed bicycle, rim brakes. I used a 26-inch mountain bike as well. Now I ride a polo-specific bicycle.
I would think you'd want a small bike for maneuverability.
Small bike is good. It keeps you from, you know, racking yourself on the top tube, or, you know, makes it a little easier to pull around as well. There are a lot of companies that are doing custom bicycles. So you send them your measurements and they build you a bike around their dimensions and try and fit it to your body specifically. But yes, definitely ride a smaller bike if you're going to come out and play polo. It's tough.
So is it like one of those little trick bikes that people use?
No, not a BMX bike. Mm-hmm. It's got 700C wheels, just like a road bike. It's got a front disc brake on the fork and runs a really, really low gear ratio so that it's easy to pedal around the court.
Because you're constantly starting off.
Mm-hmm. You stop and you go. Short bursts, lots of sprinting. Also, you're not covering very much distance, so there's no time to really build up that speed momentum.
Right. So how does the scoring go? It seems like it would be hard to play defense on a bike.
Well, you've got a mallet in your hand, so it's actually fairly easy to create like a triangular or a tripod, so where you can stay stable, no one's going to knock you over.
Oh, sure.
You can't just go by and check somebody when they're sitting on their bike. Once you're one of our pals, we'll probably give you a little bit of grief, but otherwise, you put your mallet down, you grab your brake, and you just kind of sit there. You have to have a little bit of balance and control, but after a couple of tries, you'll figure it out, no problem.
Huh. So tell me about the first time you did this.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Somebody called you up and said, hey, try it.
Yeah. So I was laying at home. My buddy gave me a call, said, come play bike polo. We need one more person because there was five there and they needed a sixth. And I was like, ah, man, I'm not doing anything. Okay, I guess I will. So I went down there, showed up, got on the bike, had no idea what I was doing, riding around this tennis court over off of... what is it, Fish Creek Park?
Uh-huh.
And I'm riding around on this bike, and I hit the ball one time, and that was when I was hooked. I didn't score a goal for the first 3 days I played. Nobody wanted to pass me a ball because I didn't know what I was doing, but I just kept showing up and kept going, and 6 years later, I'm playing tournaments all over the country.
Wow.
Haven't left country for a tournament yet. Canada doesn't count. I went to Puerto Rico this last February.
Cool.
Yeah, it's great.
So it sounds like it's not that easy to pick up the first time, though.
It's got a really steep learning curve. But once you get the basics, once you learn how to hit the ball around, once you learn how to stay up on your bicycle, it's really pretty easy after that. You start to plateau a little bit, but then there's always room to grow because the sport is so widespread across the country that you can always go and find somebody who's better than you.
That sounds like a beer or other libations are a part of this, the culture of this game.
It's a beer league sport, that's for certain. You can have as many as you'd like, but just try and stay on your bike.
When you go to tournaments, do people drink too?
Oh, yeah, all the time. there are teams of people who just drink so heavy that you wonder how they stay on their bike, and then they win the whole thing. So,
oh, wow.
It's impressive.
Is this explained part of the reason why you guys play fairly late in the evening?
Well, that's part of it. We also play fairly late in the evenings just because people work. Trying to coordinate, 12 people's day off and getting it so we can play in the daylight is hard. Here in Alaska, we are blessed to have that late sunshine in the summer months when we can actually play. So I guess really that's part of it. You want to drink beer late at night, got to work all day. So
put on some tunes.
Oh, yeah. We blast the music. We've got one of those Block Rocker sound systems from Costco. They're awesome.
Oh, this sounds really fun. People can obviously come and watch. Can people come and sort of try it out, or how do you get into it?
Well, we provide all the bikes, all the mallets, all the balls. You just got to bring yourself, bring some beer if you want. bring good attitude, and we're always generally down to, you know, meet new friends and get people playing.
Just show up, huh?
Just show up. Tuesdays, so, Thursdays, and Sundays.
Where?
Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays are going to be at 9th and E, or excuse me, 10th and E on the Park Strip by the train.
Right.
We also sometimes play at Ben Boki Sullivan Arena, just because the courts are a little bit nicer. Just get us, find us on Facebook, Anchorage's Finest Bicycle Polo, and you can really find out where exactly we're going to be and what time we're going to be there.
Yeah. So if you're jumping into a game, how long does the game take?
Games are either first to five or 15 minutes.
Okay. So, yeah, I would think that it would be a little intimidating to jump into like an hour-long game if you've never tried it before.
It'd be tough.
Yeah.
You know, riding around on and doing all that sprinting is very difficult.
Do you find to really get winded at the end of the game?
It depends on who I'm playing. That'll definitely adjust how I feel at the end of a game.
Yeah, if you're playing somebody who's really good. Yeah. So what kind of injuries would come out of this? I would think that you would be tumbling around and banging into each other, but it sounds like maybe not.
Well, a lot of people have gotten shoulder injuries, broken arms. Not a lot of people, excuse me, but there are fairly good amount of people who
not
have
unusual,
shoulder injuries.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're clipping into a bicycle that only has a front brake, so it's an inherent risk that you're going to go over your handlebars.
Why only a front brake?
Well, the front brake is the best leverage point. So if you're going to have one brake lever, it might as well be your front.
Sure, that makes sense. So you don't use like a single speed bike with like a pedal brake or anything like that?
You can. People have before. They used to ride fixed gears quite a bit. We've gotten away from the fixed gear thing. It's just you're constantly pedaling, so it's hard to line up for a shot.
Right.
But
so if you're coasting, you can make a better shot.
You can kind of square your shoulders up, line up the goal, line up the ball, hit it with the mallet.
That sounds really fun. I got to get down there and try it out, or at least watch.
It's a blast. You got to get out there. It really is. It's a great community as well, more so than just the sport itself. But the people who play are very, very accepting, very kind. Some of them have less than great humor, myself included. But, you know, we're good people. We're very, very, you know, just happy to have people out. Just ready to make new friends.
Show up, but bring a six-pack.
Yeah, bring a six-pack, bring a 12, bring a 30 rack, you know, whatever.
It depends on how popular you want to be.
Exactly. The more beer, the better.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for being here, Spencer. Spencer Mitchell is he's a bike salesman from the bicycle shop down in Diamond. Yeah, awesome. And he's with the Anchorage Bicycle Polo Club, and we will have that link to their Facebook page at outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
All right, stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
3, 2, 1, polo!
Bike polo to me is...
Bike polo to me, is, I guess, is an opportunity to...
Bike polo to me is...
Riding my bike really fast into other people.
Hanging out with friends and having a good time.
It's a chance to be a kid again.
The battle wins are pretty awesome.
Improve my bike skills.
Moving around in tight spaces, speeding up quickly, slowing down quickly.
Maneuver my bike and ride just as fast as a guy, then I could beat him to the ball.
Let off a little bit of steam.
One thing on my list that I'm doing every week in, week out...
Well, the rules of bike polo, from what I've been introduced, basically consist of 3-on-3.
Everybody lines up with their tires on the back wall. Everybody races for the ball when somebody yells 3-2-1 polo.
Shoot the ball into the goal.
And you have to hit it with the round side of your mallet for it to count as a shot, or else it's a shuffle.
Usually first to 5 or 10 to 12 minute games.
Don't put your foot down, otherwise you have to dab.
If you do, you have to tap out in the middle.
So you're out of gameplay for a minute.
Wear a helmet.
Contact rules are
bike on bike,
body to body,
mallet on mallet.
You see, you can elbow as much as you want. Whoop, ammo!
That's all you need to know.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We'll be right back.
It's Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back. I'm Charles Walforth, and today we are talking about fun with wheels. We came up with that sort of basket title for stuff you can do on bikes and on skateboards, and topics we've never really touched on. I guess we're sort of been focused more on like mountain biking and skiing and that sort of thing, but there's a lot of folks doing these sort of what I would think of as sort of alternative or different things around town. And in this segment, we're going to be talking to a boarder. Jason Borgstede was a snowboarder, and it's also been a skateboarder and has had a really interesting life. And about a year ago, he opened a new shop called the Blue and Gold Board Shop in South Anchorage to support the community of boarders in Anchorage, which, I mean, boarders is a broad category, right? It could be on wheels or not on wheels.
We even delve in a little bit into the surfing culture at this point.
Oh, really? So, cool. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your history with this sport. It's been a long journey for you to get to where you're open to shop.
Yeah, when I first moved to Alaska in 88, I decided, hey, let's not just ride around on the skateboard. Let's try to learn some tricks. That following winter, I got into snowboarding. Then I became really involved with the local scene as far as competitions with an amateur association for snowboarding and going to skateboard contests that Borderline, which was the big shop when I started, would put on. Eventually, I got sponsored by Borderline. Then I worked there after high school, and eventually that helped lead me to becoming a pro snowboarder. I went on to do a lot of really cool things with pro snowboarding. I also made videos for Borderline for 8 years with a partner.
Cool. So tell me about going pro. I mean, that's I guess every kid's dream at Alyeska to actually like make the step into where you're doing what you do for fun and get paid for it.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of exactly how I approached it. It was earlier on in snowboarding than what you see nowadays. Your interaction might be with snowboarding now. We just thought, oh, this is fun. How can I keep doing this? And you initially think, well, like baseball or football, maybe I can be a pro at it. So I headed out, started doing contests, got some good results. The local shop sponsored me. They introduced me to some people like Rick Malone, who was a founder in the boarding sport community up here. He helped push me to Burton snowboards, uh-huh. And then with some good results there, I got sponsored by those guys, started doing contests outside of Alaska and moving to Lake Tahoe for the winter. Eventually, I did really well. I won the U.S. Open Big Air contest. That led to an invite to the X Games. I did well in the summer when they would do the big slush jump out uh-huh. there in San Diego. I got a third there, and then that led to me being invited to the winter ones. The next year, I won the Big Air Winter X Games, and thus the career sets off.
So tell me what that world is like when you get into the pros, because I think we sort of think of it as being counterculture and you know, kind of different from mainstream sports. And there's an emphasis on being cool, right?
Well, it started out as counterculture. When I was young in high school, there were only a handful of us skateboarding. There were only a handful of snowboarders, really. I think the establishment, the older folks that ran ski areas or things like that, looked at snowboarding as, whoa, what's this crazy out of control thing? When we first started Alyeska, you had to have a license to shred card, which meant you went down with an instructor and had to prove that you could stop and turn in control before they would give you this card, which would allow you to ride the mountain 2 or 3 days a week.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, pretty... pretty
caveman-like.
There's
something wrong. There's something wrong with this sport. Yeah.
And strangely, I don't recall there being any certification for skiing right. at that point. So,
I don't know how many times I've almost gotten killed by the 4-year-old skiers bombing down the mountain.
Yeah. as time went on, you know, minds opened a little bit, and people could see that it was a sport that was gaining legitimacy. And it slowly has infiltrated and I guess you would say become cool everywhere. Now, when I was in high school, everybody looked down upon skateboarding. Now everybody essentially wants to be a part of that culture, even peripherally, maybe not actually participating, but they want to wear a brand that is represented from skateboarding or snowboarding or surf culture. some sort of board culture.
Yeah.
And so it's really become an accepted thing. Now the skaters are the cool kids in school. So yeah, it's definitely become quite a mainstream thing at this point.
Well, I think it's, part of the essence of the sport seems to be like doing tricks and looking good, right?
So you know, in the early days, style was the heavy emphasis. And now you have kind of a battle between being able to do as many tricks as possible versus doing things that are a little bit simpler, yet looking really good when you're doing it.
Right.
That's especially big in snowboarding. You know, we see the X Games where guys are doing what you call triple corks and spinning and flipping three times versus... a big part of the culture would say, I'd rather just see the most plain maneuver done very stylishly. And that's what would soothe my eyes the most.
Interesting. So I never really realized, I guess, that how closely skateboarding and snowboarding were linked. It sounds like you're talking, it's almost a continuum between the two.
For me personally, it is. Yeah. I grew up, I started skateboarding, and we can all see, so it started with surfing. Skateboarding wanted to mimic surfing, and then snowboarding wanted to mimic kind of a combination of the two, surfing and skateboarding. And for me, it felt like, oh, I like skateboarding. The winter's here. We live in Alaska. Can't really do that much in the winter, so why don't I do something else that looks like and feels like the same type of thing?
So... tell me about like the transition between them. Is it pretty natural, or I mean, is it the same sort of set of muscle memory and sort of mental processing that happens between skateboarding and snowboarding?
They're totally different sports, but they're the same way of I guess looking at life. You know, it's the same color rose-colored glasses you're putting on to look at things. So I approach things similarly on a snowboard as I do on a skateboard. I have a skateboard mentality when I'm snowboarding, and so I approach them with the similar. There's similar tricks. They're not done the same because in skateboarding your feet aren't attached. You can flip the board. In snowboarding, you're combining that element of almost surf-like in powder. So there's definitely, they're completely different activities, but for me, it's the same mindset for either of them.
And what is that mindset?
I mean, well, just the idea of it. Well, so I guess the best example is as a skateboarder, when that becomes a passion in your life, any real skateboarder will tell you that anytime they're driving and looking out the window, they're spotting skate spots. They don't, when you drive down the road and you see four or five stairs on the side of the road, it doesn't even register in your head. As a skateboarder, you say, oh, look, there's a five set I can jump down and do some tricks on. Or if there's a ledge, any skateboarder can tell you if that ledge has been waxed so that the boards will slide or if it hasn't. Whereas my mom would look at it and go, oh, that ledge looks a little dirty right there. And I can tell you, oh, people skateboard on that, and that's a good spot to skateboard. So we search that out, and that becomes the same in snowboarding. It becomes this passion, at least for myself, where all I want to do is pursue that, to do the activity, to think about it, to watch others do it. It becomes all consuming. It's a lifestyle. It's not just an activity, cool. At least for myself.
Cool. So I have to pull back to my like middle-aged community leader sort of perspective and think about the skateboarders messing everything up, you know, like the parks, you know, and people long ago started putting those metal things on the edges of ledges and putting up signs, no skateboarding and stuff like that. I mean, there's sort of we talked about counterculture. There's also this sort of sense that, you know, skateboarding is delinquent or it's somehow, you know, damaging and negative. And there's a little bit of, I mean, there is damage that's been caused in places by skateboarding. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with those thoughts?
There's also a lot of damage done by snowplows to every curb in town. you know, there's a lot of things. For myself, I look at it as, so first of all, it starts in youth. And adults naturally become skeptical of youth in anything they want to do outside of a confined space that they've set forth for the youth to do that in.
And then the youth want to rebel and do the opposite of what it also.
You put a basketball court out there. Okay, cool. We know that. We know what's going to happen there. We can control it. Uh-huh. That's fine. You can do that. But skateboarding is something, or snowboarding, but more so skating, is something that most adults are not going to experience. So they don't understand it. They don't understand that it's a culture. It's not just something that you pick it up, do it, and then set it down in a vacuum there. It's all encompassing. It's how you look at things. It's how you express yourself. The beautiful part of skateboarding is it has no rules. So there's no field that you have to do it on. There's no point scoring to do it. It is just your expression. You can do it any way you want to do it. And if you enjoy it, then you win. That's how you win at skateboarding.
Cool.
So, it's a little tough for adults to grasp sometimes, that lack of rule and control. And that's what makes a lot of artistic types and creative types gravitate towards skateboarding, is to be able to have that outlet to just go and express and create. And myself personally, my feeling is, and of course take it with a grain of salt because it's a little self-serving, but if a curb gets a little chipped up because of that expression and that outlet, then that's fine by me. I mean, look at all the stuff that's going on in town right now. Every other day, somebody's getting shot. Something awful's happening. If a curb getting a little darkened because some wax is on it, or a loud, aggressive noise is being made by a skateboard rolling by, I feel like that's pretty much a small worry compared to the other things people could be doing to let out that aggression and that creativity.
So in terms of your enjoyment of what you're doing, is it sort of better to find one of those spots in the field rather than going to like a set up skate park?
Well, skate park is nice because most things are perfect there, but skateboarders naturally want to have variety. If you said here's one obstacle and you can only play on that, well, eventually you're going to get bored because you will exhaust what you're capable of there. Once again, skateboarding is about not having rules. It's about freedom of expression, freedom to go when and where you want and do it the way you want. So most of the time as skaters, we're fighting for the right to skateboard, not just a place to skateboard. As culture changes and skate parks become more prolific, then that's awesome because that gives us a lot more places to do it.
Uh-huh.
And then you can feel like, okay, well, I've exhausted this. Let's go to the other park, try that for a while. Let's go to a different one. That hasn't really hit in Anchorage just yet. It's starting to. We just opened a nice park over on Russian Jack area. Mm-hmm. It has a bowl in it, which is totally new for Anchorage and Alaska in general. Concrete. The park's made of concrete. So, you know, that's a big step in the community saying, hey, we may not understand your culture, but we're not going to yank it away if you do something that we don't like. Which is what a temporary skate park does, and what it subconsciously says to our skaters. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That says, we don't understand you, but if you do something we don't like, we'll take it away.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, I don't know. I imagine it would be like having a Best Buy manager come in and tell you what you can do and say on the radio around here. And you would say, look, you have no idea what our culture and what we've created here is. So how can you tell us what is right or wrong?
Yeah. So. Cool. So how much do you think that the sort of spirit of youthful rebellion is part of this culture, and how much has it sort of grown up to become more something that isn't really so tied up in that? I mean, I have the sense that it's sort of like, you know, every generation has its way of rebelling, you know, and skateboarding seems like it was maybe part of that at one time, if it isn't now.
Yeah, absolutely. It was. I would imagine now that question lies in the heart of each individual skateboarder.
Uh-huh.
And what their struggle is coming through it. As we refer to in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, in general, if culture doesn't, or if your community doesn't approve of what you're doing, you're naturally by nature of doing it, you're being rebellious. Whether you feel like a rebel, whether rebellion is in your heart or not, or if you just want to do the activity, you are nonetheless labeled rebellious. Now, skateboarding is so accepted, so widely seen, embraced by everybody, that it naturally loses a lot of that edge.
And the generation, pardon me, that grew up sort of in the rebellion period is now the generation that's running things.
But the important thing I look at is, what were you skateboarding for? If you're skateboarding because you enjoy it, then it doesn't matter if people think you're a rebel or not. You can continue to enjoy it. If you were skateboarding just to be a rebel, then yeah, you've lost some of your edge.
You can find something else to do.
For myself, I don't care. I just wanted to skateboard because it's enjoyable. Skateboarding is awesome because it teaches you to deal with failure.
Yeah,
it's the one thing that I can fail at every single day that I do it my entire life, yet I still want to do it. It's problem solving. It's how do I make this trick happen that has given me trouble, and the satisfaction I feel when I overcome that
persistence.
Yeah, that barrier and solve the problem.
Cool. Such an interesting topic, and I'm learning a lot about this along with probably a lot of our listeners about skateboarding, and snowboarding is super related. My guest is Jason Borksteed, who's the owner of the Blue and Gold Board Shop here in South Anchorage, and a former pro snowboarder. And you were saying, Jason, also a former gambler.
I think that...
So it sounds like you've done everything, and you don't seem like that old of a guy.
I'm 41. I think that in snowboarding is a self-motivating type of... job. If you can make it a job,
it's a
self-motivating job. At least in my time it was. Now it's a little more structured. There's a little bit more of a media obligation to it. There's more of a path to success. Back then we were just told, go out, make some things happen. You're a marketing tool for the companies that sponsor you. So it's up to you to get up every day, do these things,
make it look fun.
Yeah,
right?
Make it look fun. Learn new things. The more you work at it, the better you get, the better your results are. So as snowboarding as a job trailed off for me, I wandered in, found poker, and poker was the same type of thing where if you study hard, you become better at the game and it shows in your results. It's a super tough way to make an easy living.
I bet it is.
It's stressful, and I'm happy that I don't do that anymore. But it
worked for you for a certain number of years.
Sure. Yeah, it allowed me to make a living while still getting to snowboard whenever it was good out. Uh-huh. I was living in Lake Tahoe area at the time. So I could go to Reno, play some cards, come home when it was powder day. I was out riding powder, and then I could go on. It also allowed me to make a little money while I went back to school. Then I came back to Alaska and went full bore into, I guess you would call it, regular life again.
So tell me about that transition, because that's as interesting as going the other way, when you decide to sort of settle down.
Well, it's tough. I don't know about anybody else, but I didn't choose to settle down like that. Just at a certain point, you're not the marketing tool that a company wants anymore. So you have to accept, okay, we had a good run. What do I do now?
Because they're looking for youth?
Youth or whatever they feel like they need out of it. Uh-huh. If you're not fitting the bill, then yeah, it's time to move on. So... one of the toughest things I've found to deal with is transitioning out of being a professional athlete. And I'm finding now, when we hear about some of the depression issues that pro athletes have and other people, is when you come to define yourself by something, you know, I am a snowboarder, I am a skateboarder, that will never end. But when you're allowed to live that as your entire life, day in and day out, make a living doing that, when somebody pulls that away from you and says that's all over, trying to figure out how to bring yourself back into what you would call civilian life is a very tough thing.
Well, and let me probe that a little bit, because it seems like you've described boarding as a form of personal expression. And when your personal expression is validated by the marketplace and people saying, yeah, we want you to do that. We want to watch it. We want to give you money for it. Then that really is a huge boost to your self-esteem and your sense of yourself. And when that's taken away and you're sort of just a commodity like the rest of us, and that's sort of a, is that part of the come down you're talking about?
Yeah, I think everybody knows it will come to an end at some point, but it's that false, it's like lying. You know, you say, oh yeah, I know it's going to end, but you don't really think it will. Uh-huh. You're young and you're living in the moment. And so you think, oh, this will last forever. And when it stops doing that, then I'll get a job in the industry. The industry will take care of me. Everything will be great. And then if that doesn't work out like that, you're faced with, okay, well, okay, I did a year of college and then I had to leave to pursue this dream of being an athlete. So now I'm finding myself back to how do I return to college as 30 something year old person? And how do I adapt to that? How do I make a living now that I have a mortgage while I'm trying to go back to school? And you're thrown into something that's a vastly different experience than most people are going to have.
Right.
And trying to figure that out. It's very humbling as well. You know, I came back to Alaska. I started working at the Glacier Brew House because I just needed a job. That's also where I met my awesome wife.
Oh, cool.
So great thing there. And but those guys gave me a job, gave me a chance to make a good living. But it's super humbling to, you know, I didn't say this, but it was essentially walking up to a table saying, hi, my name's Jason. I won the X Games. May I now get you some bread and water?
Right.
You know, so you have to pull yourself down and say, look, man, we're all just people. We're all just trying to enjoy ourselves in life. I had
Do you ever have customers who recognize you?
I did, yeah, from time to time. Not a lot, but yeah. But we have to, we all get to enjoy ourselves for a little while, and then it's back to reality. Yeah. And I, with the board shop, it was another way for me to figure out how to allow myself to be a part of this culture that I just cannot stay away from.
Yeah. You were talking about how, there's a community here that needs support. And one of the things you've dedicated yourself to is sort of bringing up the next generation or supporting that next generation. I'm guessing most of your customers are younger than you are.
Most of them are, but luckily, you know, a lot of the guys that grew up when I represented Anchorage in Alaska heavily when I was outside being a pro snowboarder. I would draw the state on my boards. I would do everything I could to represent the home team. And so I think that was a bit of pride for a lot of the guys I grew up riding around to say, oh, hey, one of our guys was able to make it and he's doing well in the big scheme of things. So now those guys all have kids and they're starting to bring their kids in and they're introducing them to that culture and to somebody that they know and feel like they can trust to take care of getting them on a board.
Yeah. So what are the steps thinking in terms of a parent or of a young person or whoever wants to start skateboarding? It's a pretty daunting thing to start from the beginning, right? I mean, it's not that easy to learn.
You know, skateboarding is tough because the first step that you have to get past is essentially what we call learning to ollie. An ollie is a trick where you do what's like a bunny hop on a skateboard. You're making that board pop off the ground, which is the foundation of most tricks that you're ever going to do in skateboarding. Hmm. And it is perhaps one of the most difficult things to learn when you're first starting out. And like we said, you're going to fail constantly. And in the early days that weeded out a lot of people from skateboarding. They just didn't like it. They would step on it. They would fall down.
Frustrating.
It was frustrating. And they said, oh, enough of that. I don't want to do it anymore. Uh-huh. So in turn, all of us who were skateboarders kind of wore that as a badge of honor. Like we took the abuse from everybody around town. We were able to fall down and get back up again. We were able to get over all of these hurdles to become a skateboarder. And be able to call ourselves that. So we wore that with pride, no matter what anybody else thought.
Yeah. So if you've got a young person, I've never heard of a skateboarding class. It seems like it would be contrary to the culture, huh?
A little bit. Yeah. But, you know, new times call for new measures. Uh-huh. We have some awesome team riders on our team that are really good at coaching kids or they really enjoy that. So all the events we put on, we try to have one of them there to have a small area cordoned off for people that want to just try it out. And we have them kind of walking them through it, coaching them, talking about it. So, yeah, we really try to address that. I think that it's important that the part that I love about this is making sure that people's first interaction with boarding is positive. Because if it's not positive, we lose a boarder for life. The way I liken it to is if you go to Foot Locker and you say, I want to play basketball, and they put you in a pair of high heels, you're going to go out there and have a bad time playing basketball. And you would say to yourself, why do I want to keep playing this game? This seems not fun.
Right.
So if you go to a mall store or a big box store and say, I want to snowboard or I want to skateboard, help me out. And the people that don't do that activity, don't live that lifestyle, put you on equipment that's incorrect for you, you go out and have a bad time. Well, now we've lost somebody from our potential community, somebody who could potentially contribute great things to skateboarding and snowboarding, but they left it and went somewhere else because the first experience was an awful one. Mm-hmm. So it's super important to me. It's what I emphasize most with my team, with my employees, with the whole experience, is that when you come into our store or engage in our store in any form, that it's going to be a positive experience.
Cool. It's Jason Borgstedt is our guest today on Outdoor Explorer. He's owner of the Blue and Gold Board Shop, which is down in South Anchorage near the South Restaurant. Has only been in business about a year.
Yeah.
And a challenging thing to own to start a specialty shop in a world of the internet and trying to get people to engage with it on a personal level. But it sounds like that's a really important part of it to you, is the personal interaction, the community building.
The challenging part is finding anybody who would say it was a good idea.
Right.
We have a lot of hurdles, but to be honest, it's a struggle. And just like skateboarding taught me, everything is a problem to figure out how to solve. And the shop that was around when I was young was called Borderline, or the one that had the biggest influence on myself. Uh-huh. And I felt like, even though I was rebellious, I felt nonconformist as a youth, still subconsciously we want to belong to something, even if we won't outright say it. And I felt like Borderline provided a community environment that I could belong to that made me feel safe and confident enough to explore and get to the point where I could be a pro snowboarder. So I thank that whole community for that. And now I know that that's lacking up here. And I need to step in and be the guy who can help facilitate that for the next group of kids. You know,
yeah.
What I like to say to our guys is we help people with it. If your dream is to make the best powder turn, or whether it's to be a pro in either of those sports, we need to do our best to help you get that dream accomplished.
So before we finish, I want to make sure to get in the safety part of it. I think, you know, snowboarding doesn't seem any more dangerous than skiing. Might be safer because your legs are both going the same direction. You do probably want to wear a helmet. If you're doing tricks, obviously that adds an element of danger. Skateboarding has a reputation of being fairly dangerous, and I know that like pros do get hurt, right? Because you're trying to do stuff way up in the air on a hard ground.
Yeah, you know, I guess it's all relative. I think helmets are a great idea. Unfortunately, I am not always the best at leading by example with that. In snowboarding, most of us grew up only wearing a helmet during a contest because it was required. Now I wear it a little bit more often.
And I didn't wear a helmet either as a skier, and now I've found out, wow, they're actually pretty comfortable, and you can put your headphones in them. And so I think that's sort of the fact that they've become more comfortable and user-friendly, I think, is changing that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as you get older, you find you have more to lose.
Yeah.
if a lot of people have kids, and that's, you know, once the kids come, that's often a deciding factor for a lot of adults is, hey, I can't afford to not be around for these little guys. So the helmets go on. Skateboarding, for the most part, for most people, it tends to be less impact because of the amount of momentum you're taking into it.
You're not going down a mountain.
Right. You know, the kids who are doing crazy stuff, like I mentioned in that exposure video, when you watch what those guys are doing, they're pushing the boundaries of what can be done on a skateboard.
You get online, you can see people doing incredible stuff. And sometimes you see it around town, too. Kids are like filming with their phone and they're trying to go down some kind of a railing or something.
But just naturally, it's a difficult place to, you know, when I mean a place, not a physical place, it's a difficult place to get to ask kids to wear pads everywhere. Most of skateboarding injury is going to be dings and cuts, scrapes. I hit my shin, I hurt my elbow, things like that. Less life-altering type injuries. Uh-huh. So it's tough. I mean, I'm not saying it can't happen. Okay. I'm not saying you shouldn't wear a helmet. You should, especially with the new concrete park we got with the transition and the bowl. It's easy to fall in that environment and smack your head. So it's a great idea to put our kids in helmets. And as a matter of fact, the Parks and Rec Service did an awesome job at getting a ton of free helmets donated to give out at the opening of the park.
Oh, cool.
We had ProTech come in, one of our vendors, and donate helmets that we gave away at the opening. And we definitely try to push that protective side of things.
Yeah. Well, a really interesting topic, and we will have a link to Jason's website. Jason Borgstead is the owner of the Blue Gold Board Shop. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
That's all for today's show. Eric Bork is our producer. Hannah Doro is our assistant producer and lined up today's guests. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.